Laparoscopic. Just wanted to prove I could. Good afternoon again to everyone. We lived in Maryland years ago. You'll probably get different stories over the years of things that happened there, but we lived there several, it's probably about 18, 20 years ago that we lived there. And my job was to hike all the trails in the state parks and the state forest of Garrett County. Now, if you look at Garrett County on a map, it looks like a goose flying west. So you have the wings, you have the body, and then a small little neck, and then the head. And to give you a little bit of an idea, that farthest county, the head, is Garrett County. So it's a pretty sizable county surrounded by West Virginia and Pennsylvania. Beautiful county. But I would also hike in this the connecting county of Allegheny, that neck, that thin little part. And that was my job. I was hiking for a living. That's what I did. You'll probably hear me say this again, but the first day of the job, I went in to see my boss, and she said, go get lost. And that's what I did for the next several years. I got lost. That was my job. I loved it. If there was an issue with one of the trails, I called it in for one of the crews to come and do the restoration, or I'd do it myself. But around World War II, you've probably heard the stories of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, was developed to be able to restore certain things, build certain things. Well, off of that came the MCC, the Maryland Conservation Corps, which still exists to this day. So I'd call in the Maryland Conservation Corps to be able to work on some of the trails if there was something going on, something big, or oftentimes I just did it myself. I liked the labor of it. I enjoyed being out there. But after big storms, I would strap a chainsaw on my back, and I would hike out just to be able to clear trails, snags, whatever it might be, and I would just be gone. It was a different time also because I never carried a radio, although I got in trouble for that, but I never carried a radio, and I was just by myself. It was a wonderful thing. Now you do get in trouble for things like that. But most often, I was hiking 5 to 12 miles a day, depending on what it was, every single day. That's just what I was doing. One particular day, I was assessing a trail called the 5.5 mile trail, and you guessed it, it's 5.5 miles long. It's real original names. We also had the green trail, we had the yellow trail, and it helped to be able to have that. But those were trails where a lot of times it was backcountry, cross-country skiing, which was one of our favorite sports. And so even when I wasn't working, we were doing the same thing when I had time off, and that's what we were doing. But several of the trails were loops, but the 5.5 mile trail was not a loop. So other ones, you would end where you began if it's a loop. The 5.5 mile was in one direction. If you didn't have anybody picking you up, you guessed it, you had to do the 5.5 miles back. So it was an 11-mile hike, no matter what, through the state forest. I had just finished the 5.5 mile hike and was about a mile into the return, so about 6.5 miles at this point into my hike. And I was back heading towards the trailhead where I started. And I was coming around the bend, taking everything in. I can actually remember this day. I can't remember every day that I was hiking. Obviously, that's impossible. But this one I do because of the incident that is about to happen. But I remember everything about that, where I was at that moment. So hiking the trail, it was as blue skies as you could get. It was a crisp autumn day. So just fall, the wind was, it had a coolness to it. I was still in short sleeves, but there was a coolness to it. And the smell of dead leaves, some of the trees still had green leaves, but there's already a changing, and you have the crunching under your feet at the same time. And I can remember the surroundings and what it felt like. So you have all that going on when I stopped abruptly. I just stopped in the middle of the trail. I was standing about 15 feet away from a mother black bear and her two cubs. It was a beautiful sight. The one cub was about a year old. And you think about it, these tiles under your feet are a foot long, so you count off 15, and that's how close we were. But one cub was about a year old, while the other was brand new, just a fur ball, this small little black fur ball, and he was so cute. But he was tucked into his mama. His mama's where he needs to be. That's his whole protection, and the safest place for that little cub to be is next to mama. And that's where he was, all tucked in, watching me. They were all three watching me, not sure what I was going to do. But I was upwind before seeing them, so they had no idea I was there until we were looking at each other from about 15 feet away. We were just both. We noticed each other at the same time. And it kind of startles you. My profession at the time was working with wildlife. That was mainly what I did, and the trail work on the side. But I worked with wildlife. I did a lot with conservation. I did a lot with preservation. And that was part of my career at the time. That was my education at the time. That was my calling. I knew that's what God called me to be. And it wasn't, but that's what I thought at that time. He had different plans, but that's what I thought that was going to be my calling. Being around black bears didn't bother me. Most of the time, if it's a different situation, this was a different situation. It's one that you have to kind of assess what's going to happen. Everyone knows a mother black bear or a mother bear is very protective of its cubs. It has to make a decision. What am I going to do? They're very protective. And now I was well within too close. So you have this bubble that you can be within, or you shouldn't be within, when you're working with certain wildlife. And I was well within that bubble. Of different bear species, in comparison, the black bear is extremely timid. If you ever work with black bear, they're not like other bear. They're very timid. They're not very aggressive in comparison to other bear. But on occasion, they can get aggressive, especially if they feel cornered. Do you ever corner a black bear and you won't think they're very timid or territorial, or they feel protective of something such as cubs or food or whatever that might be, they can become very protective. The Bible even talks about this. Let's go to Proverbs 17. Proverbs 17. This has a little lesson to it as well. Proverbs 17, we're going to pick it up in verse 12. Proverbs 17 and verse 12. Proverbs 17 and verse 12 says, "Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs rather than a fool in his folly." Obviously, robbing a bear of its cubs would be something very stupid to do. So this is obviously talking about a problem of encountering an irrational person. This world is filled with irrational people. Expositor says, "The human who is supposed to be intelligent and rational, and such folly becomes more dangerous than the beast that is in this case acts with good reason." That bear acts in the way that it does for good reason. There's a reason to do it. But you ever have a person around that is irrational? And I had friends that were irrational. I had friends that got me in trouble, and you say, "What were you doing? Why did you do that?" And that's what this is talking about. It's better to have the other one that can be explained. Barnes expounds by saying, "The large brown bear of Syria," which is the bear that this is talking about, "in her rage at the loss of her whelps, the cubs, was to the Israelites the strongest type of brute ferocity because they were powerful." Now, obviously, the brown bear are much bigger than black bears, but when it comes to protecting their cubs, they will do what it takes. You can find stories about this, you can find videos, you can read different things about the mother black bear protecting its cubs. I saw a video not that long ago, it's been a few months ago, but not that long ago, of a medium-sized sow that was protecting her cubs from a pretty large the male black bear, and it ended up killing the male black bear protecting the cubs, and it wasn't anywhere even close to the size. But they will do anything to protect their cubs. Pretty cool to be able to think about. But there are, you can find those. "When I came across the mother bear and her two cubs, she froze, and obviously I froze. Okay, what is going to take place? After a few seconds of having a stare off, I calmly took a slow step backward. I always kept myself facing the black bear at all time, all three of them, keeping my eyes on them. The last thing that you want to do is turn around and scream and run away. So you keep your eyes on them. They look at you. You look at them. And I slowly slid my backpack off to keep distance between me and her, just in case whatever would happen. And I figured she would run, but she stayed. She just stayed staring. So I began to speak to her in a soft voice. You know, you're a beautiful mama. And all of that. And I commented on her cubs, and they had beautiful eyes. You're usually not so close that you can see their eyes. They don't have big eyes, but these beautiful dark eyes. And I commented on her eyes as I'm walking backward. And I have to say, I was loving every minute of it. Loved it. Everything that's happening. But trying to give them space for her to realize I'm no threat. I'm not a threat at all. And at this time, I'm not the least bit worried. But pretty soon, I was about 20 feet away. Then she took a step forward, and that's when I thought, this could turn pretty quickly in the way that I didn't think it was going to go. She took a step forward. Then she went to her left and ran up an extremely steep embankment. I mean, very steep. One that would be very hard for us to run up, let alone run up. But she ran up it like it was nothing, and very quickly out of sight. For her size, she was extremely agile. And very quick. She wasn't the biggest bear I've ever seen, but she had some good size to her. Just beautiful. But an even bigger surprise was her new cub, just that tiny little cub. As tiny as it was, climbed the embankment as quickly as she did, just right tucked into Mama, all the way up. It was a beautiful moment. But she did something that I've thought about many times. Now, how many listen to the teen podcasts? Just out of curiosity. How many have listened to this teen podcast? Not very many. Okay, that's good. Okay, so just act surprised when I tell you these stories. But she did something that I have thought about many times. She, in the animal way, and I do mean animal way, animals do think, but in an animal way, not in a human way by any means, she made a decision. She made a decision. She has two options. She could fight or flight. That's her decisions. That's what she has at that moment. She had to decide what was best for her cubs. Is standing and fighting best or is fleeing best? I am glad she chose flight, which I felt she would. That's what I felt she was going to do from the beginning. She wasn't cornered or anything like that, but you never know. For people, it's not always the easiest decision to make. For us, it's never just always the easiest decision to make. Too often, I see the choice of fight in this world rather than flight. The reason for this message is we see so many things in this world that is just inflamed. And it's inflamed. It can be knocking on your door at any time. And knowing how to approach. A great blessing from God is that he gives us wisdom and discernment, very different than the animal world. He gives us wisdom and discernment. We must use them. Wisdom is a guide. It's a gift. It's a wonderful gift, but it's a guide to us. I don't want to spend much time on this, more than necessary, but the Proverbs are full of instruction on wisdom and discernment. Let's go to Proverbs 13. You're already in Proverbs. Let's go to Proverbs 13. The message is not about wisdom and discernment, but the message is about using wisdom and discernment. Proverbs 13 and verse 2. Proverbs 13 and verse 2 says, "A man shall eat well by the fruit of his mouth, how he lives. But the soul of the unfaithful feeds on violence. He who guards his mouth preserves his life," watching what he says in all situations. "But he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction." This is great for the wisdom of life, how we approach things. Too often we just let whatever fly, just everything that comes out. And oftentimes it inflames the situation that we could find ourselves in. We as in people, not we as in this congregation, just people in general. Let's go to Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15. People love just to let people have it. You can't tell me that. I will let you have it. Both barrels. Proverbs 15, verse 21 says, "Folly is joy to him who is destitute of discernment, but a man of understanding walks uprightly." Those who don't have discernment will find themselves in bad situations. You will walk into bad situations. Those who do find discernment will be walking in the right direction. These must be guides to our life. This must be how we take one step in front of the other in life, how we walk. It must be guides to how we approach life. A look at Jesus Christ's life was that of making the right decision, wisdom and discernment at all times and all situations, which didn't include fight. But it wasn't always flight either. Let's look at a few instances. We have 4 points to this message, and I think can be valuable in the world that we live in. The approach or the appropriate response isn't always stand your ground, but it isn't always flee. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to life. Point number one, looking at Jesus Christ's life, point number one is stand. Stand. Let's go to John 8. John 8. And really, we are going to have 4 points, and we could have 20 points going through the life of Jesus Christ and what he did and the actions he took and what. But I thought these were valuable for our life as well. Point one, stand. We're going to be in John 8 and verse 3. John 8, we're going to start in verse 3. It says, "Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst," and they loved doing this. This is where they were. If they could find something wrong with Jesus Christ, if they could find a problem, if they could challenge him, if they could make him trip up, anything that they could, they're always there. Verse 4, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act." Now, as has been said many times when going over this passage, where is the man? Where's the man in this? Why is it just the woman? There are two in the sin of adultery, but the concentration was on the woman in the story for whatever reason. It's a trap, but for whatever reason, there are different things said that we don't really know. You can find them in commentaries and different historians that think maybe this, maybe that. We really don't know why they only brought her. But however, there's no disputing that this action took place. Nowhere at all in Scripture is this action refuted. Jesus Christ doesn't try to refute it. Expositor says there's no indication here that Jesus challenged the charge. He didn't say, you know what, I don't know that that charge is true. I don't know if this actually took place. I don't know if she was involved or not. Not at all. He didn't do any of that. He doesn't challenge it at all. Verse 5 says, "Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" And they love doing that. We're going to use the top prophet that we can, because you can't go above Moses, and we're going to challenge you at this point. So they bring out the big dog here. And so looking at that, again, as they try to do different times, the Pharisees are trying to trap Jesus. Can we trap you? Can we make you mess up? If he agrees with them, that creates a problem. If he goes against them and what they say, that also creates a problem. If he says, yes, she should be stoned, now they go to the Romans and say he's trying to practice capital punishment on their own, and he gets in trouble. If he says, no, we should not stone them or stone her, now you're too lenient on the law of Moses and we have it in writing what we should do. That creates a problem. No matter what he does, he's trapped within that. They're so eager to make him wrong. Well, this command of Moses is within the Old Testament. Let's go ahead and head back there. We will come back to John 8. Let's go to Deuteronomy 22. Deuteronomy 22. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 22. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 22 says, "If a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die." The man's gone. "The man that lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall put away evil from Israel." Evil acts that go against God's law were to be dealt with. They were not to be left. They had to be dealt with so they didn't spread. It was a serious thing that was not to be within the nation of God's people, and it was a serious punishment. It wasn't something that was supposed to live within the nation of Israel. Let's go back to John 8. Pick it up in verse 6. John 8, verse 6. "This they said," again, testing him, "that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear." Verse 7. So they continued asking him. He raised himself up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." They kept pressing him on the issue. He didn't answer right away, so they continued asking him. Think about that situation. They're pushing and they're pushing. Okay, just trip up if we can trip you up. They didn't ask once and wait for the answer. This becomes a direct challenge to Jesus. If they continue to ask and question, then they're pressing him and challenging him. This becomes a potentially dangerous situation. They're all holding weapons, rocks, waiting. He was being challenged. He kept his calm. Jesus used incredible wisdom, but he also knew how far to take it. He stood. The law of the Old Testament, he inspired men to write. He knows the words. He knows what is there. He inspired men to write it. He knows what it said. Deuteronomy 22:22 strictly says that adulterers, both of them, shall die. It's written down. He inspired Moses to write it. He also knows the hearts of men. Impure hearts cannot condemn impure hearts. His statement is profound. "He who is without sin among you, let him throw the stone at her first." All of a sudden, this huge weight. Once that happens, this huge weight falls on their shoulders, and they're having to concentrate on the whole situation. Whether Jesus is referring to the sin of adultery or the past sin in general, it's not clear. Is it all their sins? Is it just the sin of adultery? It doesn't show. Verse 8, and again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, being with the oldest even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. It says those who heard it. Well, who heard it? They all heard it. Every single one of them. Once those words hit their ears, again, I feel like there was a tremendous weight on their shoulders. This conscience, this realization of what they were about to do. Have you ever been listening to a sermon or reading a Bible, reading your Bible, reading articles, whatever it might be, and come across something and it hits you like a ton of bricks? It's something that just opened your eyes about yourself. You're listening, you're hearing, whatever it is. I have. I've heard it. I've heard it different times. Be listening to a sermon, be reading an article, and you say, oh, I do that. Or I've done that. I'm guilty of that. Whatever that is. Whatever it might be, that conscience convicts you. That's what's happening at this moment. To throw a stone of judgment isn't just the ability to throw a stone. Not at all. Sin in their life would need to be repented of. They would need to change. They would need to be a different kind of people. These men had sin unrepented of in their life. Barnes has this little detail. It says, this was in order that the witness might feel his responsibility in giving evidence, as he was also to be the executioner. Jesus therefore put them to the test. Without pronouncing on her case, he directed them, if any of them were innocent, to perform the office of executioner. This was said evidently, well knowing their guilt, and well knowing that no one would dare to do it. All of a sudden they hear this. This is not clearing her of her sin. Her sin still remained with her at this moment. He wasn't even directed towards her. He was actually directed towards the crowd at that time. Verse 10, when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? How could they condemn her with open sin in their life? They couldn't. They couldn't at all. They themselves were not cleared of sin. They felt it. Verse 11, she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. He did not condemn her to death. He had the ability, by being perfect, to throw the stone. He could actually do it. He was the only one that could. But he says, go and sin no more. Put a stop to it. Stop living this way of life. Stop living the way that you do. Go and do what is right. She now had a choice to make. Will her life change? Will she repent? Will there be a change in her life? Will the person she is now be different than the person she was 15 minutes ago? Because this is a life-changing moment for her. We've all had them. An incredible example of the character of our Savior. But Jesus didn't back down. He stood ready for an answer. He was ready to give a defense. He was ready to give an answer. And we are to do the same thing. Let's go to 1 Peter 3. 1 Peter 3. I believe we know this. 1 Peter 3, starting in verse 15. Says, but sanctify, set apart the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Now, there are times that we need to walk away, but there are also times that we need to give an answer for what we believe. There are times that we stand and times that we give a defense. When you're walking down the street and somebody says, Merry Christmas, we don't say, okay, hold up there. Can we have a moment to talk? It's not the right moment. Not the right moment to take somebody to the side and give them a defense for what you're talking about. There will be times that you have to give a defense for what you believe, and we better know what we believe. It better be a part of who we are to know it so well. Wisdom and yielding to God's Spirit will determine when that is. But not all times are stand times. Not every moment's going to be a stand moment. Go to verse 16. It says, having a good conscience, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct, they might not like your defense. It doesn't matter. Our defense needs to be there. But they defame you as evildoers. Those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. For it is better if it is the will of God to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. So there will be times we have a choice and we need to stand. And there will be times we don't have a choice and we need to stand. Both require a defense for the hope that is in us. It better live within us. We better know it, understand it, love it. It's not to be confused with the time that we have a choice, but we don't need to stand, because sometimes that happens as well. Point number two is leave. When putting this together, I explained this in Buffalo. When putting this together, point two I had is flee. But flee gives this appearance of fear. And Jesus Christ, I didn't put him as having fear in that way. But he did leave at times when he needed to. Let's go back to John 8. Later in the chapter than we were. John 8. I'm going to pick it up in verse 48. Again, point two is leave. John 8. In verse 48. John 8, starting in verse 48, says, "Then the Jews answered and said to him, 'Do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan,'" which is the lowest thing that you could say to a Jew at that time, "or you are a Samaritan, and have a demon.'" Not nice things to say. This is after a long discussion. It's getting heated at this point. And these were words of anger. They were words of irritation. Things are not pretty at this moment. This isn't a good conversation. To them, Jesus is stepping on ground that he shouldn't. He's already said several things in their mind that weren't correct, that he's stepping again on ground that he shouldn't. And again, at this point, at this moment, he is still taking a stand. He's still standing. Verse 49, Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. And I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks and judges." Verse 51, "Most assuredly I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never die." All of a sudden something pops into their head, a challenge that they can do. These words have been so much within them. They have a lot within them, and I'm not going to concentrate outside of just his approach here. But all of this is truth. All of this is right. All of this is good. But something is about to change. It's already heated, but we're going to take it up a notch. Verse 52. "Then the Jews said to him, 'Now we know that you have a demon.'" They're trying to just poke back at him. "Abraham is dead, and the prophets," meaning the prophets, "are dead. And you say, 'If anyone keeps my word, he shall never taste death.'" You can hear the condescending attitude here. They don't understand, but they are fully challenging Jesus. They feel they have the right to do that. They think they are using his words against him, again, trying to trap him. They don't understand his words, so they're digging in their heels, and they begin to push. They begin to push back even harder against him. They're not backing down and pushing forward. And this situation is escalating. Verse 53, "And you, are you greater than our father Abraham, who is dead? And the prophets are dead. Who do you make yourself out to be?" Now he's going to start saying things they really don't like. Verse 54, Jesus answered, "If I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It is my Father who honors me, of whom you say that he is your God." A direct correlation to their God being his Father, that's blasphemy in their eyes. Verse 55, "Yet you have not known him, but I know him," a slap in the face. "And if I say I do not know him, I shall be a liar like you," a slap in the face. "But I do know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Verse 57, "Then the Jews said to him, 'You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?'" You can almost hear the crowd of Pharisees here. There's a group. They're getting upset, getting irritated by his words. This becomes completely baffling to them. They do not believe, and to them, they are just thinking in the physical. What he is implying is impossible. Then he says something to them that was even more blasphemous than all that he said in their minds. Verse 58, Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." What he said was truth, but they didn't understand. They didn't get it. He just equated himself to the one of the Old Testament. He just equated himself to the one that had continual existence from everlasting to everlasting. Verse 59. Then they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. For them, that was too much. He started saying things he shouldn't have said in their minds. They were going to stone him. It was not his time to die, and so he fled. He left. Now, Jesus wasn't fleeing because he was afraid, but that it was the appropriate thing to do. It was the right thing to do. He spoke truth. It was escalating, and it was time. His time was not come yet, so he left. Let's go to John 7. John 7, verse 28. John 7, verse 28, said, Then Jesus cried out, as he taught in the temple, saying, You both know me, and you know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. But I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me. Powerful words. Therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. His time had not come. On a few occasions, they wanted to kill him, either to throw him off of a cliff, you can find that story, or stone him. They wanted to do that on several occasions, but he didn't stay around. He left. He made the decision, okay, this is the right thing to do. My time is not yet. He used wisdom, discernment. He didn't go looking for trouble. He didn't go pick a fight. But there was a moment he approached a situation. The situation was there, it's been there for a long time, and he did confront it. Point number three is confront. Confront. Let's go to Mark 11. All the gospel accounts have this, but I like Mark's. Mark 11. And this is the time he did confront. He felt like he needed to. Mark 11 and verse 15. These are stories we're very familiar with. Mark 11, verse 15 says, So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. Some of the commentaries bring a good point here that when we see that Jesus was in the temple, that he was not in the temple itself, but the courts of the temple, the grounds of the temple. Only certain Levites were allowed to be in the temple. And also that these tables and seats and the things that they sold would not have been in the temple, but the courts of the Gentiles. And that's where this took place, in the court of the Gentiles. Something that Expositor brings out worth mentioning is this. Says, by overturning the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, Jesus was directly challenging the authority of the high priest. He confronted the situation. He continues, because they were there by his authorization. So it was a direct challenge from Jesus Christ to the high priest. The money exchanged at the money changers' tables were often done at extremely high prices. It was a lot easier, especially if the Jews had a long travel to be able to get to the temple. It was so much easier just to bring money, to be able to buy what you needed, to be able to do a sacrifice, rather than to bring your own goods along with you. And so they would do that, but they would charge an exorbitant amount for that exchange to happen. Also, the cost of the animals were done way overpriced, many times the price. I read a few things, I don't remember it now, but several things, and it was many times the price that you would normally be able to buy whatever it was that you were sacrificing. It was so very high. But it was robbery. It was thievery that was taking place. Verse 16, and he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. And with that, I read it many times. I've had the question mark, what exactly does that mean? But I've kept reading. It was not something that stopped me, but this time I did a little bit of a study into it, and so I was able to answer that. But what is carrying wares? Well, it's carrying your gear, whatever that be, whether it's a sack, your cane, the sandals on your feet, whatever it might be, whatever you're carrying. And the reason was that people were using part of the temple courts as a shortcut from getting from the eastern part of the city to the Mount of Olives. And rather than going around that large temple, rather than going around the... you could save a lot of time by just cutting right through the court. If we could do that, it saves a lot of time. It was a quick way through rather than going around. So the temple grounds became a common place. It was just a way to be able to cut off a few minutes. but it wasn't treating the grounds with respect that it needed to have. Verse 17 says, "Then he taught, saying to them, 'Is it not written, My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves.'" Look what you've created. Part of this verse is quoting Isaiah. Let's go to Isaiah 56. We'll be back to Mark. Isaiah 56. It's only the last part that he quotes. Isaiah 56 and verse 7. Isaiah 56 and verse 7. Says, "Even them I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer." We're talking about the Gentiles. "Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted by my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." And that's where he ends. If you look at verse 56, at least in or chapter 56, mine, the title of it is Salvation for the Gentiles. And that's a great heading. That's a very good heading for that. This section of Scripture is referring to the Gentiles given the opportunity for something incredible, miraculous, salvation. It said here that it shall be called a house of prayer for all nations. And instead of it being a beacon of light to the Gentiles, they're disgracing the house of God and making it common in front of all men, not giving it glory, using it as a shortcut. You can go and buy really expensive animals and be taken advantage of. Let's go back to Mark 11. Mark 11, verse 18. Mark 11 and verse 18 says, "And the scribes and the chief priests heard it and sought how they might," here they, this is how they think, "how they might destroy him. For they feared him because all the people were astonished at his teaching. When evening had come, he went out of the city." They again sought to destroy him, to kill him, discredit him, to embarrass him, anything they could. That's what they thought to do. That's what they wanted to do. But this was a time Jesus confronted the situation for who he was in the right and appropriate for him to do so. I think overall in our lives, those don't come out as much as the first two when looking at that, to stand or to leave. This one doesn't come out as much, but it will be there for moments, at moments that we do have to confront. But it's important to note that every moment is not a moment to confront. Those can be very dangerous moments, and we get to see that often if you ever look at the news or situations that you read about. Wisdom and discernment will determine when that will be. The first three points were selective in when they are done. We choose, we pick and choose, hopefully by wisdom and discernment, when they are done. For the last point is something that Jesus did at all times, still using wisdom and discernment, but it was something that he did all the time, and it's something that we must do at all times as well. Point number four. Point number four, endure. Endure. That is a choice to endure. Let's go to 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2. Pick it up in verse 18. 1 Peter 2 and verse 18 gives good instruction in this. It says, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh." And there's a lot that we could go into that one. This is actually a pretty good setup to the topic to endure. Endure means to carry on through despite of hardships. It means to undergo or suffer. Here, Peter says to be submissive to your masters always. It doesn't matter if they're good or bad, you're submissive in what you do. We can translate that to anyone who is over you. We can translate it that as our boss or whatever it might be. Not only to the good, but also to the harsh. Who answers for how they act? Everyone. Every single person answers for how they act. If you return evil for evil, you are wrong. If you return good for evil, that is commendable. As an example, I came up with a few examples. Let's just say you get in trouble for something that you didn't do. You get in trouble for something you didn't do, and you badmouth that person who's over you, or speak all kinds of evil things about that person that's over you. You would be in the wrong. All right, here's a second one. Let's now say that you get in trouble for something you did do. and you badmouth that person, and you speak all kinds of evil things about that person, you would be in the wrong. Now, here's the third one. Let's say you get in trouble for something you didn't do, and you don't badmouth that person over you, and you don't speak all kinds of bad things about that person over you, you would be in the right. And God is watching all of it. How we react, how we conduct ourselves matters in all things, whether we're right or whether we're wrong. It matters. Verse 19. And I've lost my thought. Okay, for this is commendable if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. Why is it commendable? Because God sees and you're not returning evil for evil. It's a hard thing to do sometimes, but it's required. This is one step towards developing the mind of Jesus Christ. Is that not what most messages are about, whether that topic actually comes up or not? Building the mind of Jesus Christ, what we're learning within sermonettes, within split sermons, Bible studies, the ultimate goal is to build the mind of Jesus Christ, to become more like God, and to be able to navigate this world. That's what most of it is, and that's what he's talking about here. Verse 20, for what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. Okay, I have a couple more examples here. Let's say you get in trouble for something you didn't do, and you take it patiently. You would be in the right. This isn't talking about not trying to explain yourself in a situation. You know what? I didn't actually do that. I didn't actually do those things. I'm not talking about that. This goes well beyond that. Second example is, let's now say that you get in trouble for something you did do. You take it patiently. Then you got what was coming to you. How we handle those moments also tell a lot about us. Let's say you did something wrong. Let's say I did something wrong. Let's turn the table. Say I did something wrong, and I get in trouble, and I take it patiently. You can learn a lot about somebody who takes that patiently. When we did something wrong, you take it patiently. You got what was coming to you. There's a character-building process within that as well. Verse 21, for to this you were called because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example. Isn't that the example that he was the personification of what we're to be, that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth? He left us an example to follow. He was the epitome of perfection and did no wrong. Yet he was abused, mistreated, lied about, beaten, tortured, all of those things. And yet he didn't falter once. And through the awful time, it says he left us an example that we should follow his steps. I guarantee you in the world that isn't being followed, but it is something that we are to do. Extremely hard. We might even think it's impossible, but it is something we are to strive for. Verse 23, who, when he has reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but commended himself to him who judges righteously. We can end there. Again, through the most awful time, Jesus endured great things. During this, he didn't revile, simply meaning to assail or with scornful or abusive language. He didn't strike back at them. He didn't let things just fly out of his mouth. He didn't threaten. He truly was remarkable. He truly was perfect, what we are to strive to be. Let's bring this to a close. In just four examples, and you could make many, many examples, and even Jen was saying each one of those examples, you could have messages of themselves. So this is just an overview. But in just four examples among many, he assessed the situation and knew when to stand. He knew when to leave. He knew when to confront. And he endured always. The one thing he never did was have a one-size-fits-all approach, with the exception of endure. He endured always. Some situations were not right to confront. You don't confront all situations. Not in a world that is so inflamed. We watch something that happened in a small part of the world, and it inflamed the entire world. It was something that we get to see things that happen, and everyone's angry. And we live in this world and know how to approach. But to leave wasn't appropriate also in all situations. We must follow the same example. In a world that can be everything from curious to who we are, can also be very hostile to who we are, we must know how to approach. Sometimes to stand can be good, but sometimes to leave is right and appropriate. Again, a look at Jesus Christ's earthly life was that of making the right decision in all situations, which didn't include fight, but it wasn't always flight either. We don't just have two decisions within that. Life will present many situations that we must make a decision, that wisdom and discernment of how to approach, how to respond, not just to each other as brothers and sisters, but to a world that might come to hate us. We have to know how to respond. The situation I found myself with the bear was a learning lesson for me. It was a beautiful moment, but it was a learning lesson, something I thought about for years. About an hour after my encounter with the three bears, I by chance caught up to them again. It was a really cool thing. This time I was able to watch them from about 70 feet away. And just being able to watch them, I made sure that they knew I was there. I didn't want them to think that I was a threat at all. So I would whistle and I would hum and I would walk with them. Sometimes I sat and just watched them. And we walked together for about 10 minutes or so while I watched the cubs exploring, the mother foraging in the leaf litter. And soon they just disappeared. It was amazing to watch. The shrubs were still green. Some of them were changing. But these three black bodies just all of a sudden went into the green brush and just disappeared. You couldn't hear them. You couldn't see them. And they were gone as quickly as they were there. It was a beautiful moment. But it got me to thinking on the subject of reactions. How do we react? Life is full of making the right decision in various situations that we find ourselves in. Let us use godly wisdom. Let us use godly discernment to have the right reactions to the situations of life.
Thank you, Mr. Messerly. Brethren, if you'll take up your hymnals one last time, please stand. We'll end on hymn number 69. We'll sing, "O God, our help in ages past." After this, we'll ask Mr. Mark Purdy to come forward and close services with prayer. Hymn number 69.